Morning, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Todd, representing the appellant Key Development Pension. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Briefly, this case is about the attempt to collect on two promissory notes that were executed back in 2000 and 2002 from the pension to Mr. and Mrs. Carlson. At the time the loans were made, the pension understood these to be business loans, carried the loans on their books as loans to Mr. Carlson's business, Northwest Seaplanes, and for 10 years the loans were repaid interest only by the corporation, checks drawn on their corporate account.
And what do you rely on for the statement that the funds were understood by the pension to be business loans, and your statement that they were, that the loans were carried on the books as Northwest Seaplane loans?
Mr. Johnson and Mr. Dalby both are trustees and also the beneficiaries or participants in the plan, both testified at trial that Clyde Carlson told them he was borrowing money for his airplane business. Mr. Carlson, for his part, says he doesn't remember any discussion about a purpose for the loan. In fact, says that he doesn't dispute or he doesn't claim that he told them it was for a personal use.
So the trial court made a finding about the testimony of all three witnesses, I think, saying that based on the testimony, not just the specific testimony you've relied on, but the testimony that was given, that the court was not relying on that testimony.
Well, and I think that was error because it was uncontradicted testimony and the basis was not credibility or believability. It was simply based on the length of time from the time the loans were made to the time of trial.
Your statement that the loans were carried on the books as being loans for Northwest Seaplanes, are you relying on anything other than the testimony of Mr. Johnson or Mr. Dalby?
There are documents that, in fact, were exhibits from the defendants at trial that were excerpts from the annual reports produced by compensation consultants, who are the advisors and consultants to the pension. These are reports that are given each year, and the first year was 2000 when the loan was made. Before any payment was made on that loan, it was still carried as a Northwest Seaplanes loan.
Do you agree that on the face of the loans, as those documents were written, that they would appear to be usurious?
Yes, there's nothing in the documents that state the purpose of the loan.
Okay, so the burden was on your clients to...
Absolutely, and the pension met that burden of proof. The corporate tax returns for 2000 for Northwest Seaplanes indicate that the year of that first loan of $150,000, Mr. Carlson paid back a loan from the corporation to him of $77,000. It was listed as a $77,000 loan to shareholders beginning of the year, zero balance at the end of the year. That same tax return also shows a zero balance from loans from shareholder at the beginning of the year, but an $87,000 loan from Mr. Carlson to the corporation at the end of that year, a change of $160,000. And as I indicated earlier, also the payments every year for 10 years were made on checks drawn on the corporation. Every check. I think the most important issue here is whether the Carlsons qualify to even raise the usury defense based on their not being people who the Supreme Court has said are not entitled to raise that defense, namely that they weren't by adversity and necessity of economic life driven to borrow money at any cost.
That's not what the statute says.
The statute does. That's what the Supreme Court said interpreting the statute.
But the statute doesn't say that. So then you're relying exclusively on the Supreme Court case.
Interpretation of the statute in 1988, which has gone unchallenged, or the legislature is not deemed to change the Supreme Court's opinion. In fact, this court in 1989 said the same thing in the Stevens case, where they said that Mrs. Stevens, who borrowed money to build a luxury condominium, was not the type of person that the usury statute was designed to protect, simply because she was not a person who needed to borrow the money. So, and I think that that is an important case in this situation. I think in 1881, when the business purpose exemption was amended, Judge Becker, I think you were actually in the legislature at that time, and I think we can all remember what interest rates were back in the early 80s. The prime rate was somewhere above 21% at one time. So the Supreme Court in 88 noted that change in the law in the business exemption from a no business exemption until 1969, and then an exemption for loans that had to exceed $50,000 and be exclusively for business purposes, to changing it a few years later to $100,000, but still saying exclusively for business purposes, to the 1981 amendment, which changed it to be primarily for agricultural, investment, commercial, or business purposes. So from that, the Supreme Court determined that there was this trend towards limiting the applicability of the usury statute to only in those cases where it was absolutely necessary. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Marcia Ellsworth. I represent Clyde and Priscilla Carlson, the respondents in this case. This is a classic and typical usury case, and it's our position that Judge Needy, the trial court judge, got it right. He was correct. He listened to the testimony of the witnesses. He reviewed the documents.
What's your response to the argument that's been made that there was evidence that the loan was carried on the books as a loan to Mr. Carlson's company? And what is your response to the argument that every payment was made on the corporate account that reflects Seaplane?
Several points with respect to that, Your Honor. First of all, the argument was made that the pension plan used the name Northwest Seaplanes as they referred to the loan in their annual reports. And case law is pretty clear on that. The purpose of the lender in making the loan is always business. The fact that they decided to put the name, we have no idea why they put the name Northwest Seaplanes in their annual reports. The note was made to Clyde Carlson and Priscilla Carlson personally.
So there was evidence that in the annual reports the loan was listed for Northwest Seaplanes.
Yes, there was evidence of that. But there was no evidence.
Why did the court take that into consideration? How did that affect the court's determination?
I think the court did take that into consideration. And looking at the evidence as a whole, especially when the court looked at the documentation of the Carlson loan versus the documentation of other loans that the pension plan made, where the pension plan did clearly document those loans as business loans, having the borrower make a representation in the loan documents that it was exclusively for a business purpose, first, and second, in the promissory note, the note was made payable to the business with the individual either as a guarantor or as an additional borrower.
So the payments that Mr. Carlson made through all the years, and there were many, were all made by check on the corporate seaplane account. So why doesn't that show that the loan was for a business purpose?
I think two primary reasons. Number one, for purposes of establishing usury, the law states that we look at the objective manifestation of purpose at the inception of the loan. So point number two is it really doesn't matter who made the payments. I could have made the payments, and it doesn't make it my loan. So the fact that the payments came from the corporation has nothing to do with the objective manifestation of intent at the inception of the loan.
Well, Mr. Carlson didn't remember. So what explanation was there for why he was writing these checks all these years?
The explanation was that's where the money was.
What does that mean?
What that means is Mr. Carlson's income was seasonally derived from his Northwest Seaplanes business, and it's a simple accounting entry. It was easier for him to write checks from the corporation to pay for this debt.
Did he testify to that, or is that an inference?
He testified that that's where he derived his income from.
Well, did he testify that it was easier to write the check from Seaplane, or is that an inference?
I think it's an inference, Your Honor. And that's coupled with the testimony of the CPA, who testified that was, one, not an unusual presentation in a small business such as Northwest Seaplanes, and the corporation didn't carry the loans on its books, and there was some rise and fall with respect to shareholder loans, which was consistent with the corporation making personal payments for the Carlsons.
Now, we've also listened to argument about the listing of the loan at the end of 1 year being $77,000 and then $80,000, and there was a fluctuation in the valuation. What's your response to that argument?
My response to that argument is it's simply that it's just an argument. The plaintiff did not put on any testimony from an expert, and that does call for an expert opinion about...
Plaintiff, you mean your client?
No, the pension plan.
Okay.
It does call for an expert opinion as to what those numbers mean. And at the end of the day, after hearing testimony about it, the trial court judge, I think, concluded that's interesting, that's some evidence, but the most persuasive evidence was on the face of the loan documents itself, again, going back to what happened at the inception of the loan.
What case law are you relying on for the proposition that you only look at the documents at the inception of the loan or the testimony related to the objective at the inception of the loan?
That's the Aetna versus Darwin case, and I believe that's also discussed in the New West case and also the Brown versus Geiger case.
Now, we have the argument about the usury statute not applying to your clients and the Supreme Court case that's been relying on. What's your response to that?
Two or three points on that. First of all, that language in those courts' decisions is dicta. And here's why that's dicta.
I was going to say, how do you know?
How do I know? In both of those cases.
And what we're talking about, which cases?
We're talking about Stevens versus Security Pacific and Brown versus Geiger. The Boski versus Russell case was decided in 1965, which was prior to the usury statute. So in Stevens and Brown, those are both opposite cases of what we're dealing with here. In both Stevens and the Brown case.
So what is it, you're arguing it's factually distinguishable. But how do we know that what the court said in those cases is dicta?
Because the court held that neither of the defendants were entitled to the usury defense because the objective manifestations of intent for the loans was in the documents. It was in there. There was a variety of documentation in both of those loans where the borrowers stated it was for a business or commercial purpose. And after the fact, they tried to get out of it to say, oh, no, it's really for a personal purpose. On that basis alone, the court held that they weren't entitled to the usury exception, and then went on to say, in the Stevens case, said, furthermore, as in justifying its holding the borrower to their initial statement, said furthermore, and then went through that discussion. And the same is true in the Brown versus Geiger case. Instead of using furthermore, in that case, the court said moreover, and gave the same explanation. And I think point number three on that is the plain reading of the statute today, and the statute that was effective in 2000 and 2002 with respect to the Carlson notes, says this section shall not apply to a consumer transaction of any amount. So the focus of the statute is on the purpose of the loan, not the quality of the borrower or the kind of borrower. And if the legislature wanted to have a finding made or an exception made for a certain type of borrower, it would have put that in the statute, and it didn't. So I guess
your argument there is you're saying that consumer loans, you mean like credit card loans or something like that, I mean, you can charge higher than 18%, right?
Yes.
Even though those people might be quite desperate and needy.
Yes, and that's a specific exception to the usury statute. And the statute goes on to describe consumer transactions as a transaction that was primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. We respectfully request that this court affirm the holding of the trial court in favor of Mr. Carlson. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Geiger was not dicta. The analysis consumes an entire section of the opinion. It's Roman numeral 2 of the opinion. There's a lengthy 3-page analysis of the evolution of the business purpose exemption from the inception in 1969 through the 1981 amendments. And they specifically apply that analysis to the facts of the case.
Now, do you agree that the facts of that case and the facts of the Stevens case are not like the facts in this case?
In that there was no written documentation of the purpose.
Yes.
That's correct. But in the Brown case, the trial court, we don't know exactly what they relied on, but the trial court said that this was a business loan. I'm assuming it was based on the documentation. The Court of Appeals, however,
very unusual. It would be very unusual, would it not, to see a Supreme Court case where you have a statute that doesn't have those words in it, and the Supreme Court just decides to write a whole new test into the statute with words that don't exist in the statute at all. I mean, that's an unusual act of statutory interpretation in Washington law.
Eight of the nine justices signed on to that opinion.
I understand that, but all the more reason why perhaps your interpretation that they actually introduced a new test into the statute and made it a statutory test is, deserves a very careful scrutiny. And I'm saying that, you know, you just don't see that where the Supreme Court says, well, we have this statute. We think that it was designed for this purpose, and just to make sure it's not applied to anybody who doesn't fit in that purpose, we're going to take a new paragraph and write it into the statute and make it part of the test.
Well, that's what they did, I believe, and this court in the Stevens case adopted that same analysis and said that the purpose that Mrs. Stevens borrowed the money for was not something.
Is there any other case you can think of in any context at all, not loans, not anything, but where the Supreme Court has done that very thing, where they've said, well, we have the statute, but the way the statute is written, it's incomplete. We're going to write a whole new section and graft it onto the statute.
Well, I don't think they necessarily, I think what they looked at is where do you draw the line from consumer loans to loans that may be investment loans? In fact, the Carlsons testified at trial that the proceeds for the first loan were used to remodel a vacation home in Chelan, a vacation home in Arizona, and to buy a new one in Campbell River, Canada. Now, this is not the kind of activity, just like Mrs. Stevens purchasing a luxury condominium or building a luxury condominium, that the usury statute was designed to protect. And that, I think, is valid, and the legislature hasn't done anything about that interpretation for the last 20-some years.
Thank you.
Thank you.